Thanks, Daniel. I love this word ubiquitous, partly because at home in New Zealand there's one of these big super yachts called Ubiquitous, and I've seen it a couple of times, and I've always thought, wouldn't it be great to have one of those or borrow it or something? Because being a mathematician, it's never going to be possible, but, well, you can live in hope. Anyway, what I didn't know was there's a verb, ubiquity. Ubiquitous just means they're everywhere, and this is the message I want to give you today. These alternating groups come up almost everywhere, kind of surprisingly, where you have discrete structures with a large degree of symmetry. Often many of the well-known examples have small symmetry groups. Well, the structures themselves are small, but the ratio of the number of symmetries to the size of the object is large. It often happens when you're in that situation that it turns out that all but finitely many alternating groups have the same property. Now, of course, the structures are large, but they still fall into the same family, and that's what I want to talk about today. Whole range of examples, but just the general context, we're talking about symmetries of discrete structures. A lot of the talks this week have been about, well, this week so far, have been about graphs and maps and polytopes, but as you'll see, there'll be some other structures that come up as well. Just a small digression, a shameless plug like I gave last week. Next February, there's to be a conference on the symmetries of discrete objects around the other side of the world in New Zealand. Summer, I should point out, February, when it's freezing cold here and raining and sleeting and snowing. You can come and enjoy some sunshine in New Zealand. Sorry. We have almost 60 participants registered so far, and which is a bit scary because that was about the number I was hoping for. But it promises to be a very good meeting. So if you can find your way, if you can escape from your classes and find your way around the other side of the world, it'd be great to see you. And this is a view from the, I think it's from the restaurant at the Skyline at the top of the cable car, where we might have the conference dinner, depending on how the finances go. So I'm going to start off talking about compact Riemann surfaces and regular maps. I've talked about these things already this week, but perhaps some of you haven't been there. First of all, if you take a compact Riemann surface of genus G, or equivalently a complex algebraic curve of genus G, and the genus is bigger than 1, then the number of orientation-preserving or conformal automorphisms is bounded above by 84 times G minus 1. That's a classical theorem due to Hurwitz from 1893. Moreover, when the bound is met, the group of symmetries is a Hurwitz group. It's a 2-3-7 group, so it's a quotient of the 2-3-7 triangle group. And the same thing holds for regular maps. You have a regular map of genus G bigger than 1. Already you're saying the group is large because it acts transitively on the darts. I'm talking about the orientation-preserving case. On orientable surfaces, but already the group is large because it acts transitively. But if you want the group to be as large as possible with respect to the genus, then again the type has to be 3-7 to get the maximum order, and again it's 84 times g minus 1. If you allow reflections, the maximum becomes twice that, 168 times g minus 1, and instead of the ordinary triangle group, you take the full triangle group generated by reflections. There are lots of examples of Hurwitz groups. Gabe Real mentioned them in his last talk, but there's a whole string of examples. Every Hurwitz group is perfect, so it coincides with its commutator subgroup. That means it always has a maximal normal subgroup that with quotient that's a non-abelian simple group. These groups aren't solvable, they don't have solvable quotients, they have to have non-solvable, the proper quotients are all non-solvable, so it makes sense to start looking at simple groups and then extensions by simple groups of other groups. And there's a whole range of them known now, including 12 of the 26 sporadic simple groups. It's known completely which of the sporadic groups are, including the monster. Historically, it was the PSL2s that were shown to be Hurwitz groups to begin with. That was done by Macbeth in the late 60s. And then my doctoral supervisor, Graham Higman, proved that all but finitely many of the alternating groups AN are Hurwitz groups, and then in my doctoral thesis I figured out exactly which ones are. So all but 64, in fact, of the alternating groups are 2-3-7 groups. Gareth Jones here in the second row proved that the regroups, Hurwitz groups, more recently some of the other groups of Lie type, particularly for large rank, been shown to be Hurwitz groups using this result about the alternating groups. And as I said, there are various extensions of those. Let me just explain how it's possible to prove this result about the alternating group. I'm going to show what are called coset diagrams, because later on I'm going to refer to coset diagrams without actually showing them. So I'm going to spend a bit of time on this example just to get across the point about what they are. So those of you who came to the graduate course lecture last Thursday will know about them. Some of the rest of you will as well. But essentially a coset diagram is just a diagrammatic way of illustrating a permutation representation of a finitely generated group on a finite set. Well, even an infinite set, actually. And here's an example. You take the 2-3-7 triangle group. You have here's a presentation for it. You can either generate in terms of two elements, x and y, of orders 2 and 3, whose product is order 7, or you can throw in a third generator if you want. But, of course, that third generator is just the inverse of the product of the other two. But a permutation representation is specified by assigning permutations to those elements. They have to satisfy the right relations. So this one here is order 2, this is order 3, this is order 7. And if you work out the product of them, you get the identity. But another way of describing those permutations is to draw this little diagram. And let's take the element of order 3 to start with y. It takes 1 to 2 to 3. So it just permutes the three points around that triangle anticlockwise in a 3-cycle. Similarly, 4, 5, 6, it permutes these in a 3-cycle. It fixes the point, the seventh point, 7. So I've represented that by a heavy dot. I could have made a loop, but loops are cumbersome, so it's better to put a heavy dot, as long as you remember. Heavy dot means fixed point. Right? And then x swaps 3 and 4, swaps 6 and 7. It fixes 1, 2, and 5. And again, rather than put loops, I just ignore those, as long as you remember that if a point of a triangle doesn't have an x edge coming out of it, then it's fixed by x. And I'm not even going to bother indicating z, because z is the inverse of the product of the other two. So all of this information here is encapsulated in this diagram. And I don't even need the numbers on it, because, you know, you can get rid of the numbers. You can label them any way you like. It's still a transitive permutation representation on 7 points. So I can throw away the numbers, and all I need is the diagram. I just need the triangles, the x edges, and the heavy dots. That's it, full stop. Right? So these give you a really nice way of describing transitive, well, even intransitive, permutation representations of a finitely generated group. Another nice thing about these particular diagrams is that you can join them together in order to create new ones that correspond to permutation representations of the same group. So suppose you have one of these diagrams and it's got one of these free triangles there. So it's got a couple of fixed points of x that lie in a cycle of y. And suppose we have another one that's got the same kind of thing. Then I can create a new one by adding two more edges indicating x, swapping the two points from the top diagram with two points on the bottom diagram. Now, I haven't changed y. Y is exactly the same as it was. It induces a certain permutation on these points and a certain permutation on the points of this diagram. So it induces the same permutation on the points of the overall diagram. All I've done is change x by adding a couple of 2-cycles. So here I'm swapping these two points and these two points. Now, that means x still has order 2 because it's made up of a bunch of 2-cycles, all represented by the free edges in this diagram. Y still has order 3 because y hasn't changed at all. All you have to do is check x, y, and if you do a bit of diagram chasing, you'll find that previously when you say started from here, you go x, y to there, 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 and around a bit. When you do the same thing over here, you go x, y to here, x, y to here, x, y to here, rather than here, and then x, y to here, x, y to here, and x, y to here. But all you've actually done is swapped that point for that point. And it works the same the other way around, and so the resulting diagram is still a diagram for the 2-3-7 triangle group, and therefore it gives you another permutation representation of the 2-3-7 triangle group. And the nice thing about it means you can build up larger and larger representations just by knowing what the diagrams are that you start with. It's not a vertex, yeah. Good point. Yeah, that cross there is not a vertex. Maybe I should have drawn them in different colours, but yeah. So these little triangles have vertices, but that one there is just a crossing of two edges. Good question. Now, what this means is you can use this composition technique to string copies of these diagrams together to get all sorts of things. So you can use it to prove certain groups are infinite. You can take a single copy that might have a couple of these nice free things and just use those to join successive copies together, and you take arbitrarily many and you get an infinite degree transitive permutation representation. Or you can take a whole lot that are the same and then do something slightly different at one end. You might do it in such a way that it destroys reflexibility. These diagrams along here might all have reflexive symmetry around a horizontal axis, in which case they would be coset diagrams for the full 2-3-7 triangle group. And then if you add on one at the end that obviously isn't symmetric about the same axis, then you can destroy the reflexibility and make it chiral, in which case you get a chiral map rather than a reflexible map. Or you can add something that has strange cycle structures of other elements, and then when you take a suitable power of some word in the generators X and Y, you can make that power act trivially on all this stuff and act non-trivially on this part. And then something called Jordan's theorem and permutation group theory. Well, first of all, you can use that often to prove the representation, the new big representation is primitive, and then you can use Jordan's theorem to prove you've got the alternating or symmetric group. Well, in this case of 2-3-7, you won't get the symmetric group, but you can get the alternating group. So you can do all these tricks with coset graphs. You can destroy symmetry in a number of ways. You can destroy reflexibility. You can destroy uniformity of cycle lengths, and get alternating and symmetric groups. So that's exactly what was done. Well, what I did for the 2-3-7 generation of alternating groups 30 years ago. Okay, now let's move to another topic: symmetric graphs. Symmetric graphs. Well, a graph is called vertex transitive if its automorphism group acts transitively on vertices. It's edge transitive if it automorphism group acts transitively on edges, and so on. If the automorphism group acts transitively on ordered pairs of adjacent vertices, those are called arcs, then the graph is called symmetric. And the notion of an arc is extendable to that of an S-arc, which is a walk, not of length 1, but a walk of length S. And the only condition is that if you're taking a walk, you don't immediately step back along the edge that you took. So it's a sequence of S plus 1 vertices such that any two successive ones are adjacent and any three consecutive ones are distinct. And there's a very nice theorem due to Bill Tutt, who, as many of you know, spent most of his academic career in Ontario, Waterloo. He proved that if you have a three-valent finite connected symmetric graph, then the order of its automorphism group is bounded above by 48 times the number of vertices. That bound is sharp, and it's attained if and only if the graph is what's called five-arc transitive, which means the automorphism group has a single orbit on the five arcs, these walks of length 5. Here's an example of one. It's called Tutt's 8 cage. It's actually the smallest. It's on 30 vertices, number of ways of defining it, but The diagram illustrates some of its symmetry, but in fact it has a lot more. So it has its automorphism group is the outer automorphism, no, it's the full automorphism group of S6. Djokovic, who was also at Waterloo, and Miller in 1980 used the theory of amalgams to show that in that best possible case, five arc transitive, the automorphism group has to be a quotient of a certain finitely presented group that they called 5. We now call it G5. it's essentially an amalgamated free product of the vertex stabilizer and the edge stabilizer with the arc stabilizer amalgamated. And here's an alternative presentation for it. It might not look nice, but it is nice because the relations are all very short. But essentially, in this presentation, you've got six generators. The first five of them generate the vertex stabilizer, which is a group of order 48. The last five of them generate the edge stabilizer, which is a group of order 32, I think, yes. And then these successive subgroups generate the stabilizer of an arc, a two arc, a three arc, and a four arc. The last one, the stabilizer of a four arc, is one of the generators of order 2. And the nice thing is you can reconstruct symmetric graphs using non-degenerate quotients of that group, and Norman Biggs made, well, he made a kind of conjecture. Back in the early 80s, the only known five-arc transitive cubic graphs were Tutt's 8-cage and some other graphs called sextet graphs and some covers of those, and something called Wong's graph. They were all really based on graphs that came from subgroup structure within projective special linear groups. And then in some work with my colleague Peter Lorimer, I found a new one that had S10, the symmetric group of degree 10, as its automorphism group, so that was a completely new one. And then not long after, I was able to prove that, in fact, all but finitely many alternating and symmetric groups are the automorphism groups of these five-arc transitive cubic graphs. So in fact, that these best possible cubic graphs with respect to F-arc transitivity were actually not that rare. And the way I proved it was using coset diagrams, but not coset diagrams for triangle groups, but coset diagrams for that group I gave before, the G5 group. And the idea is that inside the vertex stabilizer, there is a subgroup of index 3, which is the arc stabilizer. And so when you're looking at permutation representations of this group, you can consider orbits of the vertex stabilizer. They decompose into suborbits of the arc stabilizer. And the arc stabilizer is normalized by an edge-reversing automorphism, the one called A in the presentation. So A actually normalizes the subgroup. And so any permutation representation you can decompose first into orbits of the vertex stabilizer, then into suborbits, and the suborbits are linked together by two cycles, or fixed points sometimes, of the arc-reversing involution. So it's the same kind of trick. Once you know that, you can then take coset graphs for, well, you can take coset graphs for the vertex stabilizer, that group of order 48, very easy to find them, and then you consider ways of joining them together in such a way that you get big permutation representations of the group G5 that satisfy the right condition. And again, the same trick works. You can string copies of the same kind of thing together. You can string some other ones together where the number of points is co-prime to the first one, and that way you can get representations of arbitrarily large degree, and then if you fiddle with them at one end or other, you can make sure you get the alternating or symmetric group. That's essentially the trick there. Richard Weiss is also in the audience. Sometime after Tutt proved using the classification of doubly transitive permutation groups that there are no finite 8-arc transitive graphs apart from two cycles. Like no connected ones apart from two cycles. A two-cycle is S-arc transitive for any value of S you like. Yeah. What is an S-arc in a two-cycle? Take a cycle graph. What is an S-arc? You start at a vertex and you either go round and round and round and round that way or round and round and round that way, however far you want to go. But any two of those things are equivalent as long as they have the same value of S. But if you go to valency bigger than 2, Richard proved that there are no examples that are 8 or more arc transitive. So 7 arc transitive is the best possible. Moreover, he proved that in the 7 arc transitive case, the valency has to be of the form 1 plus 3 to the power t, So again, using classification of doubly transitive permutation groups. And in the smallest case, where the valency is 4, the automorphism group has to be a quotient of this nice group. Now, again, you know, it looks horrible, but in fact it's really nice, because all the relations are really short. And in fact, you use exactly the same trick as I used before. The vertex stabilizer is generated by all but one of the elements. The arc stabilizer is generated by a subgroup of those. There's one other element left over called B. You do exactly the same trick as before. No, the coset graphs. Each of these boxes is a coset graph for the vertex stabilizer.
Yes.
And then you make the whole thing a coset
graph.
Very unlikely. I mean, you could do, but it would probably be too large. So, yeah. So, same trick works there. With a PhD student a few years ago, we used that trick to prove, again, that all but finitely many alternating and symmetric groups are the automorphism groups of these 7 arc transitive 4 valent groups. Up till then, I think the only examples known came from finite geometries. Hyperbolic 3 manifolds. These are like generalizing Riemann surfaces to the next dimension up. So you're in hyperbolic 3 space rather than hyperbolic 2 space. Instead of looking at the area of a fundamental region, that's what you essentially do to prove Hurwitz's theorem, which gives you a bound on the number of automorphisms of the surface. In this case, you look at the number of isometries of the surface, and you relate that to the volume of a fundamental domain for the action of, for the manifold. And there is a theorem that says there is an upper bound on the quotient, on that quotient, the number of isometries related to the volume. And it's known that because that set of volumes is discrete, well, because the set of values is discrete, it's known that this is attained. Now, there's a theorem that had a very long gestation period. It was actually proved in about, kind of proved in about 2001. Didn't finally appear until 2 years ago in the Annals of Maths, but it's a theorem by a former colleague of mine, a PhD student from our department, and Fred Gehring, who's at Michigan. They proved that the group that was thought to give this best known value in the case of 3 manifolds was the best, and it's fortunately related to Coxeter groups. So you take the Coxeter group 353, the one generated by reflections. There's a just string C group, I suppose, if you want to call it that. But you add an extra, you add a duality in a sense. You add an involutory automorphism of that group that swaps A and D, and it swaps B and C. Because the orders of these products, A, B, B, C, and C, D, are symmetric, you know, with a 5 in the middle and 3 either side, you have this external automorphism. And the theorem says that this ratio, for hyperbolic 3 manifolds, this ratio is maximized when the group is a quotient of the orientation-preserving subgroup of this one extended by this graph symmetry. So we call that group, we call the big one this group, and we call the little one this group. So this is the orientation preserving subgroup of the Coxeter group, and this is extended by the symmetry. Gonna have to go faster. Anyway, so this group is the analog of the 237, ordinary 237 triangle group. And cut a long story short, turns out that this group has all but finitely many alternating and symmetric groups as quotients. So in other words, all but finitely many alternating symmetric groups occur as large symmetry groups of hyperbolic 3 manifolds, where large means large number of symmetries to volume ratio. And the trick is more or less exactly the same. It's a bit different this time, because rather than starting with orbits of some group and joining them together, what we do is we start with known things and then we fiddle with the connections. But it comes to the same thing. Two more. locally, SARC transitive grass. I think Julie talked about this last week. But instead of SARC transitive grass, if you just assume that all the SARCs that start from a particular vertex are equivalent under some automorphism fixing the vertex, then the graph's called locally SARC transitive. If you also assume it's edge transitive, then your vertex is going to lie in one of up to two possible classes of vertices. So if the graph is edge transitive but not vertex transitive, then it's going to be bipartite, and given every edge, one of the vertices will lie in one class, one orbit of the automorphism group, and its neighbours will lie in the other orbit. But there's a theorem due to Stellmacher, which actually I'm not sure has appeared in print, but it's believed to be true. If the finite connected edge transitive graph is locally S-arc transitive, then S is at most 9. So it's a Now, until a few months ago, the only known graphs meeting this bound were generalized octagons, so coming from finite geometries. I heard Michael Giudice talk about this at Rogler in end of June, and I thought that sounds like a good candidate for alternating groups, and sure enough, within a few days had this. For all but finitely many n, the alternating group is the automorphism group of a locally 9-arc transitive graph, bipartite graph connected, in which the vertices in one part have valency 3 and the vertices in the other part have valency 5. And again, it's done by coset diagram techniques. The way I did it was to go to the smallest known example, and that has this regroup as its automorphism group. It's the group that has the Keats simple group as the subgroup of index 2. That group happens to be a free product of subgroups A and B of these orders. These intersection has index 3 in one of them and index 5 in the other. And all you do is you take coset graphs for that. Well, you take coset graphs for each of those groups and use their intersection to provide the glue in between. And this result pops out. Finally, polytopes. We've just heard lots of lectures today about polytopes, so I won't go over all of this stuff. I will just remind you of one of the results that Dimitri gave us this afternoon. He said that he and Marie-Alice proved that for every n bigger than 3, the symmetric group Sn is the automorphic group of some regular abstract R polytope for each R between 3 and n minus 1. Now, if you turn that around, instead of making n the subject, make R the subject. What it means is for every given R bigger than or equal to 3, all but finitely many symmetric groups are the automorphism groups of some R polytope. Right? So regular R polytopes, well, they're known to be plentiful anyway. What about chiral polytopes? Well, I'm not going to go through the definition of chiral because that's been given as well. We know there are... We know specific examples of rank up to 8, and Daniel has proved very nicely that there exist chiral polytopes of every possible rank. I have a conjecture that the Fernandez-Lehmann's result, well, you're not going to be surprised at this stage, but I have a conjecture that for any R bigger than or equal to 3, all but finitely many of the alternating groups, AN, occur as the full automorphism groups of chiral, otherwise maximally symmetric, and the symmetric groups as well, of chiral polytopes of rank R. Now, this is where it helps Gabe, I think, because the construction I believe that will work says take an alternating group which is known to be the Coxeter group 3333 for appropriate number of threes, take permutation representations of that group, string them together using the coset diagram technique to give you representations of the orientation preserving subgroup of the 3333K Coxeter group, right? And if those are chosen correctly, you will end up with a chiral polytope. Now, I know this is true for enormous numbers of alternating groups in the case where R is 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And I think Gabe in many cases this K can be chosen to be coprime to 3. Where is he? Coprime to 3. And given that the alternating groups are simple, I think it probably gives you examples that you want. And that's it. Just time for no pictures. Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, no, the degree has to be more than two, otherwise.
But you can have 3 and 5,
yeah? Yes, yeah. But until this latest result, the only 3-5 examples known were from the finite geometry and from certain covers of that, yeah. Which is, yeah.
Can I invite any further question to ask it directly, or can I be with an out of time? So we thank you.